breath. Kristen, someone was taking me to see Kawahara on board Head in the Clouds. Someone from the Y Clinic. And if Kawahara is involved in the West Coast houses, then they'll do anything that turns a profit, because she will do anything, anything at all. You wanted a big bad meth to believe in? Forget Bancroft. He's practically a priest in comparison. Kawahara grew up in Fission City, dealing anti-radiation drugs to the families of fuel rod workers. Do you know what a water carrier is? She shook her head. In Fission City, it's what they used to call the gang enforcers. See, if someone refused to pay protection or inform to the police or just didn't jump fast enough when the local Yakuza boss said frog, the standard punishment was to drink contaminated water. The enforcers used to carry it around in shielded flasks, siphoning off low-grade reactor cooling systems. They'd turn up at the offender's house one night and tell him how much he had to drink. His family would be made to watch. If he didn't drink, they'd start cutting his family one by one until he did. You want to know how I know that delightful piece of Earth history trivia? Ortega said nothing, but her mouth was tight with disgust. I know because Kawahara told me. That's what she used to do when she was a kid. She was a water carrier, and she's proud of it. The phone chimed. I waved Ortega back out of range and went to answer it.
Kovac?
It was Rodrigo Bautista.
Is Ortega with you?
No, I lied automatically. Haven't seen her for a couple of days. Is there a problem?
Probably not. She's vanished off the face of the planet again. Well, if you do see her, tell her she missed the squad assembly this afternoon and Captain Murawa wasn't impressed.
Should I expect to see her?
With Ortega, who fucking knows?
Bautista spread his hands.
Look, I gotta go. See you around.
See ya. I watched as the screen blanked, and Ortega came back from her place by the wall. Did you get that?
Yeah. I was supposed to turn the Hendrix memory disks over this morning. Murawa will probably want to know why I took them out of Fell Street in the first place.
It's your case, isn't it?
Yeah, but there are norms.
Ortega looked suddenly tired.
I can't stall them for long, Kovac. I'm already getting a lot of funny looks for working with you. Pretty soon someone's going to get seriously suspicious. You've got a few days to run this scam on Bancroft, but after that...
She raised her hands eloquently. Can't you say you were held up? That Cadman took the disks off you?
They'll polygraph me.
Not immediately.
Kovac, this is my career we're flushing down the toilet here, not yours. I don't do this job for fun. It's taken me...
Kristen... Listen to me. I went to her and took her hands in mine. Do you want Riker back or not? She tried to turn away from me, but I held on.
Kristen, do you believe he was set up?
She swallowed.
Yes.
Then why not believe it was Kawahara? The cruiser he tried to shoot down in Seattle was heading out over the ocean when it crashed. You extrapolate that heading and see where it takes you. You plot the point where the Coastals fished Mary Lou Hinchley out of the sea, then put Head in the Clouds on the map, and see if it all adds up to anything. Ortega pulled away from me with a strange look in her eyes.
You want this to be true, don't you? You want the excuse to go after Kawahara no matter what. It's just hate with you, isn't it? Another score to settle. You don't care about Riker. You don't even care about your friend Sarah any...
Say that again, I told her coldly, and I'll deck you. For your information, nothing that we've just discussed matters more to me than Sarah's life. And nothing I've said means I have any option other than to do exactly what Kawahara wants.
Then what's the fucking point?
I wanted to reach out for her. Instead, I turned the yearning into a displacement gesture with both hands chomping gently at the air. I don't know. Not yet. But if I can get Sarah clear, there might be a way to bring Kawahara down afterwards. And there might be a way to clear Riker, too. That's all I'm saying. She stayed looking at me for a moment, then turned and swept up her jacket from the arm of the chair where she had draped it when we arrived.
I'm going out for a while, she said quietly.
Fine. I stayed equally quiet.
This was not a moment for pressure. I'll be here, or I'll leave a message for you if I have to go out.
Yes, do that.
There was nothing in her voice to indicate whether she was really coming back or not. After she had gone, I sat thinking for a while longer, trying to flesh out the glimpse of structure that the envoy intuition had given me. When the phone chimed again, I had evidently given up because the chime caught me staring out of the window, wondering where in Bay City Ortega had gone. This time, it was Kawahara.
"I have what you want," she said offhandedly. "A dormant version of the Rawling virus will be delivered to Silset Holdings tomorrow morning after 8 o'clock. Address, 1187 Sacramento. They'll know you're coming."
"And the activator codes?"
"Delivery under separate cover. Trep will contact you."
I nodded. UN law governing transfer and ownership of war viruses was clear to the point of bluntness. Inert viral forms could be owned as subjects for study, or even, as one bizarre test case had proved, private trophies. Ownership or sale of an active military virus, or the codes whereby a dormant virus could be activated, was a UN indictable offense, punishable with anything between 100 and 200 years storage. In the event of the virus actually being deployed, the sentence could be up to erasure. Naturally, these penalties were applicable only to private citizens, not military commanders or government executives. The powerful are jealous of their toys. "Just make sure she contacts me soon," I said briefly. "I don't want to use up any more of my 10 days than I have to."
"I understand."
Kawahara made a sympathetic face, for all the world as if the threats against Saro were being made by some malignant force of nature over which neither of us had control.
"I will have Irene Elliott re-sleeved by tomorrow evening. Nominally, she is being bought out of storage by Jaxall S.A., one of my communications interface companies. You'll be able to collect her from Bay City Central around 10 o'clock. I have you temporarily accredited as a security consultant for Jaxall Division West. Name, Martin Anderson."
"Got it." This was Kawahara's way of telling me that if anything went wrong, I was tied to her and would go down first. "That's going to clash with Riker's gene signature. He'll be a live file at Bay City Central as long as the body's decanted." Kawahara nodded.
"Dealt with. Your accreditation will be routed through Jaxall corporate channels before any individual genetic search. A punching code. Within Jaxall, your gene print will be recorded as Anderson's. Any other problems?"
"What if I bump into Sullivan?"
"Warden Sullivan has gone on extended leave. Some kind of psychological problem. He's spending some time in virtual. You will not be seeing him again."
Despite myself, I felt a cold shiver as I looked at Kawahara's composed features. I cleared my throat. "And the sleeve repurchase?"
"No."
Kawahara smiled faintly.
"I checked the specs. Irene Elliott's sleeve has no biotech augmentation to justify the cost of retrieving it."
"I didn't say it had. This isn't about technical capacity, it's about motivation. She'll be more loyal if..."
Kawahara leaned forward in the screen. "I can be pushed so far, Kovach. And then it stops. Elliot's getting a compatible sleeve. She should be thankful for that."
"You wanted her. Any loyalty problems you have with her are going to be your problems exclusively. I don't want to hear about it."
"She'll take longer to adjust," I said doggedly. "In a new sleeve, she'll be slower, less
Also, your problem. I offered you the best intrusion experts money can buy, and you turned them down. You've got to learn to live with the consequences of your actions, Kovach."
She paused and sat back with another faint smile.
"I had a check run on Elliot. Who she is, who her family is, what the connection is, why you wanted her off stack. It's a nice thought, Kovach,
but I'm afraid you're going to have to support your own Good Samaritan gestures without my help. I'm not running a charity here.
No, I said flatly. I suppose not.
No. And I think we can also suppose that this will be the last direct contact between us until this matter is resolved.
Yes.
Well, inappropriate though it may seem, then, good luck, Kovac.
The screen blanked, leaving the words hanging in the air. I sat for what seemed like a long time, hearing them, staring at an imagined afterimage on screen that my hate made almost real. When I spoke, Riker's voice sounded alien in my ears, as if someone or something else was speaking through me. "Inappropriate is right," it said into the quiet room. Motherfucker. Ortega did not come back, but the aroma of what she had cooked curled through the apartment, and my stomach flexed in sympathy. I waited some more, still trying to assemble all the jagged edges of the puzzle in my mind. But either my heart was not in it, or there was still something major missing. Finally, I forced down the coppery taste of the hate and frustration, and went to eat. Chapter 30. Kawahara's groundwork was flawless. An automated limo with Jaxall insignia lightning flashed onto its flanks turned up outside the Hendricks at 8 the next morning. I went down to meet it and found the rear cabin stacked with Chinese designer-labeled boxes. Opened back in my room, the boxes yielded a line of high-quality corporate props that Serenity Carlyle would have gone wild for. 2 blocky, sand-colored suits cut to Riker's size, a half-dozen handmade shirts with the Jaxall logo embroidered on each wing collar, formal shoes in real leather, a midnight blue raincoat, a Jaxall-dedicated mobile phone, and a small black disc with a thumbprint DNA encoding pad. I showered and shaved, dressed, and ran the disc. Kawahara blinked up on the screen, construct perfect.
"Good morning, Takashi-san, and welcome to Jaxall Communications. The DNA coding on this disc is now webbed into a line of credit in the name Martin James Anderson. As I mentioned earlier, the punch-in corporate prefix for Jaxall will negate any clash with Riker's genetic records or the account set up for you by Bancroft. Please note the coding below."
I read off the string of digits in a single sweep and went back to watching Kawahara's face.
"The Jaxall account will bear all reasonable expenses and is programmed to expire at the end of our 10-day agreement. Should you wish to dissolve the account earlier than this, double-punch the code, apply the gene trace, and double-punch again. Trep will contact you via the corporate mobile sometime today, so keep the unit with you at all times. Irene Elliott will be downloaded at 2145 West Coast time. Processing should take about 45 minutes, and by the time you receive this message, Silset Holdings will have your package. After consultation with my own experts, I have appended a list of the likely hardware Elliot will need, and a number of suppliers who can be trusted to acquire it discreetly. Charge everything through the Jaxall account. The list will print out in hard copy momentarily. Should you need any repetition of these details, the disc will remain playable for the next 18 minutes, at which point it will self-wipe. You are now on your own."
Kawahara's features arranged themselves in a PR smile, and the image faded as the printer chittered out the hardware list. I scanned it briefly on my way down to the limo. Ortega had not come back. At Silset Holdings, I was treated like a Harlan family heir. Polished human receptionists busied themselves with my comfort, while a technician brought out a metal cylinder, roughly the dimensions of a hallucinogen grenade. Trep was less impressed. I met her early that evening, as per her phoned instructions, in a bar in Oakland, and when she saw the Jaxall image, she laughed sourly.
"You look like a fucking programmer, Kovac. Where did you get that suit?"
"My name's Anderson," I reminded her. "And the suit goes with the name." She pulled a face.
"Well, next time you go shopping, Anderson, take me with you. I'll save you a lot of money, and you won't come out looking like a guy takes the kids to Honolulu on weekends.
I leaned across the tiny table. You know, Trep, last time you gave me a hard time about my dress sense, I killed you. She shrugged.
Goes to show, some people just can't take the truth.
Did you bring the stuff? Trep put her hand flat on the table, and when she removed it, there was a nondescript gray disc sealed in impact plastic between us.
There you go, as requested. Now I know you're crazy.
There might have been something like admiration in her voice.
You know what they do to you here on Earth for playing with this stuff?
I covered the disc with my own hand and pocketed it. Same as anywhere else, I guess. Federal offense, down the double barrel. You forget, I don't have any choice. Trep scratched an ear.
Double barrel or the big wipe? I haven't enjoyed carrying this around all day. You got the rest of it there?
Why? Worried about being seen in public with me? She smiled.
A bit. I hope you know what you're doing.
I hope so, too. The bulky grenade-sized package I'd collected from Silset had been burning a hole in my expensive coat pocket all day.
I went back to the Hendrix and checked for messages. Ortega had not called. I killed time in the hotel room, thinking through the line I was going to feed Elliot. At 9, I got back in the limo and took it down to Bay City Central. I sat in a reception room while a young doctor completed the necessary paperwork, and I initialed the forms where he indicated. There was an eerie familiarity to the process. Most of the clauses in the parole were on behalf of stipulations, which effectively made me responsible for Irene Elliott's conduct during the release period. She had even less say in the matter than I'd had when I arrived the week before. When Elliot finally emerged from the restricted zone doors beyond the reception rooms, it was with the halting step of someone recovering from a debilitating illness. The shock of the mirror was written into her new face. When you don't do it for a living, it's no easy thing to face the stranger for the first time. And the face that Elliot now wore was almost as far from the big-boned blonde I remembered from her husband's photocube as Riker was from my own previous sleeve. Kawahara had described the new sleeve as compatible, and it fitted that bleak description perfectly. It was a female body, about the same age as Elliot's original body had been, but there the resemblance ended. Where Irene Elliot had been big and fair-skinned, this sleeve had the sheen of a narrow vein of copper seen through falling water. Thick black hair framed a face with eyes like hot coals and lips the color of plums, and the body was slim and delicate. Irene Elliot? She leaned unsteadily on the reception counter as she turned to look at me.
Yes? Who are you?
My name is Martin Anderson. I represent Jaxal Division West. We arrange for your parole. Her eyes narrowed a little, scanning me from head to foot and back again.
You don't look like a programmer. Apart from the suit, I mean.
I'm a security consultant, attached to Jaxal for certain projects. There is some work we would like you to do for us.
Yeah? Couldn't get anyone else to do it cheaper than this?
She gestured around her.
What happened? Did I get famous while I was in the store?
In a sense, I said carefully. Perhaps it would be better if we dealt with the formalities here and moved on. There is a limousine waiting.
A limo?
The incredulity in her voice put a genuine smile on my face for the first time that day. She signed the final release as if in a dream.
Who are you really?
She asked when the limousine was in the air. It felt like a lot of people had been asking me that over the past few days. I was almost beginning to wonder myself. I stared ahead over the navigation block of the limo. A friend, I said quietly. That's all you need to know for now.
Before we start anything, I want...
I know. The limousine was banking in the sky as I said it. We'll be in Ember in about half an hour. I hadn't turned, but I could feel the heat of her stare on the side of my face.
You're not corporate, she said definitely. Corporates don't do this stuff. Not like this.
The corporates do whatever turns a profit. Don't let your prejudices blind you. Sure, they'll burn down entire villages if it pays, but if having a human face is what cuts it, they'll whip out a human face and put it on.
And you're the human face?
Not exactly.
What's the work you want me to do? Something illegal?
I pulled the cylindrical virus loader out of my pocket and passed it across to her. She took it in both hands and examined the decals with professional interest. As far as I was concerned, this was the first test. I'd pulled Elliot out of the store because that way she would be mine in a way no one supplied by Kawahara or skimmed off the street would ever be. But beyond that, I had nothing to go on but instinct and Victor Elliot's word that his wife was good. And I was feeling slightly queasy about the direction I'd let things go. Kawahara was right. Good Samaritan gestures can be expensive.
So let's see. You've got a first-generation Simultech virus here.
Scorn made her enunciate each syllable slowly.
Collector's item. Practically a relic. And you've got it in a state-of-the-art rapid deployment jacket with anti-locational casing. Why don't you just cut the crap and tell me what's really in here? You're planning a run, aren't you?
I nodded.
What's the target?
Virtual whorehouse, AI managed. Elliot's new lips parted in a soundless whistle.
Liberation run?
No, we're installing.
Installing this?
She hefted the cylinder.
So what is it?
Rawling 4851. Elliot stopped hefting abruptly.
That's not funny.
Wasn't intended to be. That's a dormant Rawling variant, set for rapid deployment, as you so rightly observed. The activation codes are in my pocket. We are going to plant Rawling inside an AI whorehouse database, inject the codes, and then weld the lid shut on it. There's some peripheral stuff with monitoring systems and some tidying up, but basically that's the run. She gave me a curious look.
Are you some kind of religious nut?
No, I smiled faintly. It's nothing like that. Can you do it?
Depends on the AI. Do you have the specs?
Not here. Elliot handed me back the deployment jacket.
I can't tell you then, can I?
That was what I was hoping you'd say. I stowed the cylinder, satisfied. How's the new sleeve?
It's okay. Any reason why I couldn't have my own body back? I'll be a lot faster in my own...
I know. Unfortunately, it's out of my hands. Did they tell you how long you've been in the store?
4 years, someone said.
4 and a half, I said, glancing at the release forms I'd signed. I'm afraid in the meantime someone took a shine to your sleeve and bought it.
Oh.
She was silent then. The shock of waking up inside someone else's body for the first time is nothing compared to the sense of rage and betrayal you feel knowing that someone somewhere is walking around inside you. It's like the discovery of infidelity, but at the intimacy range of rape. And like both these violations, there's nothing you can do about it. You just get used to it. When the silence stretched, I looked across at her still profile and cleared my throat. You sure you want to do this right now? Go home, I mean? She barely bothered to look at me.
Yes, I'm sure. I have a daughter and a husband who haven't seen me in nearly 5 years. You think this...
She gestured down at herself.
...is going to stop me?
Fair enough. The lights of Ember appeared on the darkened mass of the coastline up ahead, and the limousine began its descent. I watched Elliot out of the corner of my eye and saw the nervousness setting in. Palms rubbing together in her lap, lower lip caught in her teeth at one corner of her new mouth. She released her breath with a small but perfectly audible noise.
"They don't know I'm coming?"
she asked. "No," I said shortly. I didn't want to follow this line of conversation. "The contract is between you and Jaxall West. It doesn't concern your family."
"But you arranged for me to see them. Why?"
"I'm a sucker for family reunions." I fixed my gaze on the darkened bulk of the wrecked aircraft carrier below, and we landed in silence. The auto limo banked around to align itself with the local traffic systems and touched down a couple of hundred meters north of Elliot's data linkage. We powered smoothly along the shore road under the successive hollows of Ancona Salamau and parked immaculately opposite the narrow frontage. The dead monitor doorstop had been removed and the door was closed, but there were lights burning in the glass-walled office at the back. We climbed out and crossed the street. The closed door proved to be locked as well. Irene Elliott banged impatiently at it with the flat of one copper-skinned hand, and someone sat up sluggishly in the back office. After a moment, a figure identifiable as Victor Elliott came down to the transmission floor, past the reception counter and toward us. His gray hair was untidy and his face swollen with sleep. He peered out at us with a lack of focus I'd seen before on data rats when they'd been cruising the stacks for too long. Jackhappy.
"Who the hell?"
He stopped as he recognized me.
"What the fuck do you want, Grasshopper? And who's this?"
"Vic."
Irene Elliott's new throat sounded 9/10 closed.
"Vic, it's me."
For a moment, Elliot's eyes ran a volley between my face and the delicate Asian woman beside me, and then what she had said smacked into him like a truck. He flinched visibly with the impact.
"Irene?"
he whispered.
"Yes, it's me,"
she husked back. There were tears leaking down her cheeks. For moments they stared at each other through the glass. Then Victor Elliott was fumbling with the locking mechanism of the door, shoving at the frame to get it out of the way, and the copper-skinned woman sagged across the threshold into his arms. They locked together in an embrace that looked set to break the new sleeve's delicate bones. I took a mild interest in street lamps up and down the promenade. Finally, Irene Elliott remembered me. She disengaged from her husband and twisted around, smearing the tears off her face with the heel of one hand and blinking bright-eyed at me.
"Can you?"
"Sure," I said neutrally. "I'll wait in the limo. See you in the morning." I caught one confused look from Victor Elliott as his wife bustled him inside. I nodded good-naturedly at him and turned away to the parked limo on the beach. The door banged shut behind me. I felt in my pockets and came up with Ortega's crumpled pack of cigarettes. Wandering past the limo to the iron railing, I kindled one of the bent and flattened cylinders and for once felt no sense that I was betraying something as the smoke curled into my lungs. Down on the beach, the surf was up, a chorus line of ghosts along the sand. I leaned on the railing and listened to the white noise of the waves as they broke, wondering why I could feel this much at peace with so much still unresolved. Ortega had not come back. Cadman was still out there. Sarah was still under ransom. Kawahara still had me by the balls. And I still didn't know why Bancroft had been killed. And despite it all, there was space for this measure of quiet. Take what is offered, and that must sometimes be enough. My gaze slipped out past the breakers. The ocean beyond was black and secret, merging seamlessly with the night a scant distance out from the shore. Even the massive bulk of the keeled-over Free Trade Enforcer was hard to make out. I imagined Mary Lou Hinchley hurtling down to her shattering impact with the unyielding water, then slipping broken beneath the swells to be cradled in wait for the sea's predators. How long had she been out there before the currents contrived to carry what was left of her back to her own kind? How long had the darkness held her? My thoughts skipped aimlessly, cushioned on the vague sense of acceptance and well-being. I saw Bancroft's antique telescope, trained on the heavens, and the tiny motes of light that were Earth's first hesitant steps beyond the limits of the solar system. Fragile arcs carrying the recorded selves of a million pioneers, and the deep-frozen embryo banks that might someday re-sleeve them on distant worlds, if the promise of the vaguely understood Martian astrogation charts bore fruit. If not, they would drift forever, because the universe is mostly night and darkened ocean. Raising an eyebrow at my own introspection, I heaved myself off the rail and glanced up at the holographic face above my head. and Kana Salamao had the night to herself. Her ghostly countenance gazed down at repeated intervals along the promenade, compassionate but uninvolved. Looking at the composed features, it was easy to see why Elizabeth Elliot had wanted so badly to attain those heights. I would have given a lot for that same detached composure. I shifted my attention to the windows above Elliot's. The lights were on there, and as I watched, a female form moved across one of them in naked silhouette. I sighed, spun the stub of my cigarette into the gutter, and took refuge in the limo. Let Ancona keep the vigil. I called up channels at random on the entertainment deck and let the mindless barrage of images and sounds numb me into a kind of half-sleep. The night passed around the vehicle like cold mist, and I suffered the vague sensation that I was drifting away from the lights of the Elliot's home, out to sea on snapped moorings with nothing between me and the horizon, where there was a storm building. A sharp rapping on the window beside my head shook me awake. I jerked around from the position I'd slumped into and saw Trepp standing patiently outside. She gestured at me to roll down the window, then leaned in with a grin.
"Kawahara was right about you. Sleeping in the car so this dipper can get laid. You've got delusions of priesthood, Kovach."
"Shut up, Trepp," I said irritably. "What time is it?"
"About 5.
Her eyes swiveled up and left to consult the chip.
5:16. Be getting light soon."
I struggled into a more upright position, tasting the residue of the single cigarette on my tongue. "What are you doing here?"
"Watching your back. We don't want Cadman taking you out before you can sell the goods to Bancroft, do we? Hey, is that the records?"
I followed her gaze forward to the entertainment deck, which was still screening some kind of sports coverage. Minuscule figures rushed backwards and forwards in a cross-hatched field, accompanied by a barely audible commentary. A brief collision between two players occasioned an insectile roar of cheering. I must have lowered the volume before I fell asleep. Switching the deck off, I saw in the ensuing dimness that Trepp had been right. The night had washed out to a soft blue gloom that was creeping over the buildings beside us like a bleach stain on the darkness.
"Not a fan, then?"
Trepp nodded at the screen.
"I didn't used to be, but you live in New York long enough, you get the habit."
"Trepp, how the fuck are you supposed to watch my back if your head is jammed in here watching the screen?"
Trepp gave me a hurt look and withdrew her head. I climbed out of the limo and stretched in the chilly air. Overhead, Ancona Salamao was still resplendent, but the lights above Elliot's were out.
"They stayed up until a couple of hours ago,"
Trepp said helpfully.
"I thought they might be running out on you, so I checked the back."
I gazed up at the darkened windows. "Why are they going to run out on me? She hasn't even heard what the terms of the deal are."
"Well, involvement in an erasure offense tends to make most people nervous."
"Not this woman," I said, and wondered how much I believed myself. Trepp shrugged.
"Suit yourself. I still think you're crazy, though. Kawahara's got dippers could do this stuff standing on their heads."
Since my own reasons for not accepting Kawahara's offer of technical support were almost entirely instinctive, I said nothing. The icy certainty of my revelations about Bancroft, Kawahara, and Resolution 653 had faded with the previous day's rush of setup details for the run, and any sense of interlocking well-being had gone when Ortega left. All I had now was the gravity pull of mission time, the cold dawn, and the sound of the waves on the shore. The taste of Ortega in my mouth, and the warmth of her long-limbed body curled into mine, were a tropical island in the chill, receding in my wake.
"You reckon there's something open this early that serves coffee?" I asked.
"Town this size?"
Trepp drew breath in through her teeth.
"Doubt it, but I saw a bank of dispensers on the way in. Got to be one that does coffee."
"Machine coffee?" I curled my lip.
"Hey, what are you, a fucking connoisseur? You're living in the hotel that's just one big goddamn dispenser. Christ, Kovach, this is the machine age. Didn't anybody tell you that?"
"You got a point. How far is it?"
Couple of clicks. We'll take my car. That way, if little Miss Homecoming wakes up, she won't look out the window in panic.
Sold. I followed Trep across the street to a low-slung black vehicle that looked as if it might be radar invisible, and climbed into a snug interior that smelled faintly of incense. This yours?
No. Rented. Picked it up when we flew back in from Europe. Why?
I shook my head. Doesn't matter. Trep started up, and we ghosted silently along the promenade. I looked out of the seaward window and wrestled with an unsubstantial sense of frustration. The scant hours of sleep in the limo had left me itchy. Everything about the situation was suddenly chafing at me again, from the lack of solution to Bancroft's death to my relapse into smoking. I had a feeling that it was going to be a bad day, and the sun wasn't even up yet.
You thought about what you're going to do when this is over?
No, I said morosely. We found the dispensers on a frontage that sloped down to the shore at one end of town. Clearly they'd been installed with beach clientele in mind, but the dilapidated state of the shelters that housed them suggested the trade was no better here than for Elliot's data linkage. Trep parked the car, pointing at the sea, and went to get the coffees. Through the window I watched her kick and slam the machine, until it finally relinquished two plastic cups. She carried them back to the car and handed me mine.
Want to drink it here?
Yeah, why not? We pulled the tabs on the cups and listened to them sizzle. The mechanism didn't heat especially well, but the coffee tasted reasonable, and it had a definite chemical effect. I could feel my weariness sliding away. We drank slowly and watched the sea through the windshield, immersed in a silence that was almost companionable.
I tried for the envoys once,
Trep said suddenly. I glanced sideways at her, curious. Yeah?
Yeah, long time ago. They rejected me on profile. No capacity for allegiance, they said.
I grunted. Figures. You were never in the military, were you?
What do you think?
She was looking at me as if I just suggested she might have a history of child molesting. I chuckled tiredly. Thought not. See, the thing is, they're looking for borderline psychopathic tendencies. That's why they do most of their recruiting from the military in the first place. Trap looked put out.
I've got borderline psychopathic tendencies.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. But the point is, the number of civilians with those tendencies and a sense of team spirit is pretty limited. They're opposing values. The chances of them both arising naturally in the same person are almost nil. Military training takes the natural order and fucks with it. It breaks down any resistance to psychopathic behavior at the same time as it builds fanatical loyalties to the group. Package deal. Soldiers are perfect envoy material.
You make it sound like I had a lucky escape.
For a few seconds, I stared out at the horizon, remembering. Yeah. I drained the rest of my coffee. Come on, let's get back. As we drove back along the promenade, something had changed in the quiet between us. Something that, like the gradually waxing light of dawn around the car, was at once intangible and impossible to ignore. When we pulled up outside the data broker's frontage, Irene Elliott was waiting, leaning against the side of the limo and watching the sea. There was no sign of her husband. Better stay here, I told Trap as I climbed out. Thanks for the coffee.
Sure.
I guess I'll be seeing you in my rearview screen for a while, then.
I doubt you'll see me at all, Kovach,
Trap said cheerfully.
I'm better at this than you are.
Remains to be seen.
Yeah, yeah. Be seeing you.
She raised her voice as I started to walk away.
And don't fuck up that run. We'd all hate to see that happen.
She backed up the car a dozen meters and kicked it into the air in a showy, dropped-nose bunt that shattered the quiet with a shriek of turbines and barely cleared our heads before flipping up and out over the ocean.
Who was that?
There was a huskiness to Irene Elliott's voice that sounded like the residue of too much crying. Back up, I said absently, watching the car trail out over the wrecked aircraft carrier. Works for the same people. Don't worry, She's a friend.
She may be your friend,
Elliot said bitterly.
She isn't mine. None of you people are.
I looked at her, then back out to sea. Fair enough. Silence, apart from the waves. Elliot shifted against the polished coachwork of the limo.
You know what's happened to my daughter,
she said in a dead voice.
You knew all the time.
I nodded.
And you don't give a flying fuck, do you? You're working for the man that used her like a piece of toilet tissue.
Lots of men used her, I said brutally. She let herself be used. And I'm sure your husband's told you why she did that as well. I heard Irene Elliott's breath catch in her throat and concentrated on the horizon, where Trepp's cruiser was fading into the pre-dawn gloom. She did it for the same reason she tried to blackmail the man I was working for, the same reason she tried to put drivers on a particularly unpleasant man called Jerry Sadaka, who subsequently had her killed. She did it for you, Irene.
You fuck!
She started to cry, a small, hopeless sound in the stillness. I kept my eyes fixed on the ocean. I don't work for Bancroft anymore, I said carefully. I've swapped sides on that piece of shit. I'm giving it a chance to hit Bancroft where it hurts, to hit him with the guilt that fucking your daughter never gave him. Plus, now that you're out of the store, maybe you'll be able to get the money together and re-sleeve Elizabeth. Or at least get her off stack, rent her some space in a virtual condo or something. The point is, you're off the ice, you can do something, you've got options. That's what I'm offering you. I'm dealing you back into the game. Don't throw that away. Beside me, I heard her struggling to force down the tears. I waited.
You're pretty impressed with yourself, aren't you?
She said finally.
You think you're doing me this big favor, but you're no fucking good Samaritan. I mean, you got me out of the store. But it all comes at a price, right?
Of course it does, I said quietly.
I do what you want, this virus run. I break the law for you, or I go back on stack. And if I squeal or screw up, I've got more to lose than you. That's the deal, isn't it? Nothing for free.
I watched the waves. That's the deal, I agreed. More silence. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw her look down at the body she was wearing, as if she'd spilled something down herself.
Do you know how I feel?
She asked.
No. I slept with my husband, and I feel like he's been unfaithful to me.
A choked laugh. She smeared angrily at her eyes.
I feel like I've been unfaithful to something. You know, when they put me away, I left a body and a family behind. Now I don't have either.
She looked down at herself again. She lifted her hands and turned them, fingers spread.
I don't know what I feel,
she said.
I don't know what to feel.
There was a lot I could have said. A lot that has been said, written, researched, and disputed on the subject. Trite little magazine-length summings up of the problems inherent in resleeving. How to make your partner love you again in any body. Trite, interminable psychological tracts. Some observations of secondary trauma in civil resleeving. Even the sanctified manuals of the fucking envoy corps itself had something trite to say on the matter. Quotes, informed opinion, the ravings of the religious and the lunatic fringe. I could have thrown it all at her. I could have told her that what she was going through was quite normal for an unconditioned human. I could have told her that it would pass with time, that there were psychodynamic disciplines for dealing with it, that millions of other people survived it. I could have even told her that whichever god she owed nominal allegiance to was watching over her. I could have lied. I could have reasoned. It all would have meant about the same. Because the reality was pain, and right now there was nothing anyone could do to take it away. I said nothing. The dawn gained on us, light strengthening on the closed-up frontages behind us. I glanced at the windows of Elliot's data linkage. "Victor?" I asked.
"Sleeping."
She wiped an arm across her face and snorted her tears back under control like badly cut amphetamine.
"You say this is going to hurt, Bancroft?"
"Yeah. In a subtle way, but yeah, it'll hurt."
"Installation run on an AI,"
Irene Elliott said to me.
"Installing an erasure penalty virus. Fucking over a known meth. You know what the risks are? You know what you're asking me to do?"
I turned to look her in the eye. "Yes, I know." Her mouth clamped down on a tremor.
"Good. Then let's do it."
Chapter 31. The run took less than 3 days to set up. Irene Elliott turned stone cold pro and made it happen that way. In the limo back to Bay City, I laid it out for her. At first she was still crying inside, but as the detail mounted, she clicked in, nodding, grunting, stopping me and backing me up on minor points I hadn't made clear enough. I showed her Raylene Kawahara's suggested hardware list, and she okayed about 2/3 of it. The rest was just corporate padding, and Kawahara's advisors, in her opinion, didn't know shit. By the end of the journey, she had it down. I could see the run already unfolding behind her eyes. The tears had dried on her face, forgotten, and her expression was clean purpose, locked-down hate for the man who had used her daughter, and an embodied will to revenge. Irene Elliott was sold. I rented an apartment in Oakland on a Jaxall account. Elliott moved in, and I left her there to catch up on some sleep. I stayed at the Hendricks, tried to do some sleeping of my own without much success, and went back 6 hours later to find Elliott already prowling about the apartment. I called the names and numbers Kawahara had given me and ordered the stuff Elliott had ticked. The crates arrived in hours. Elliott cracked them open and laid out the hardware across the floor of the apartment. Together, we went through Ortega's list of virtual forums and worked it down to a short list of 7. Ortega had not turned up, or called me at the Hendricks. Mid-afternoon on the second day, Elliott kicked on the primary modules and cruised each of the shortlist options. The list fell to 3, and Elliott gave me a couple more items to go shopping for. Refinement software for the big kill. By early evening, the list was down to 2, with Elliott writing up preliminary intrusion procedures for both. Whenever she hit a glitch, we backed up and compared relative merits. By midnight, we had our target. Elliott went to bed and slept 8 solid hours. I went back to the Hendricks and brooded. Nothing from Ortega. I bought breakfast in the street and took it back to the apartment. Neither of us felt much like eating. At 10:15 local time, Irene Elliott calibrated her equipment for the last time. We did it. 27.5 minutes. "A piece of piss," Elliott said. I left her dismantling equipment and flew out to see Bancroft that afternoon. Chapter 32.
"I find this exceptionally difficult to believe,"
Bancroft said sharply.
"Are you quite sure I went to this establishment?"
Below the balcony on the lawns of Suntouch House, Miriam Bancroft appeared to be constructing an enormous paper glider from instructions and a moving holoprojection. The white of the wings was so bright it hurt to look directly at them. As I leaned on the balcony rail, she shaded her eyes from the sun and looked up at me. "The mall has security monitors," I said, affecting disinterest. "Automated system, still operational after all these years. They've got footage of you walking right up to the door. You do know the name, don't you?"
"Jacket Up? Of course I've heard of it, but I've never actually used the place."
I looked around without leaving the rail. "Really? You have something against virtual sex, then? You're a reality purist?"
"No."
I could hear the smile in his voice.
"I have no problem with virtual formats, and as I believe I've told you already, I have used them on occasion. But this place, Jacket Up, is, how can I put it, hardly the elegant end of the market."
"No," I agreed. "And how would you classify Jerry's closed quarters? an elegant whorehouse?
Hardly.
But that didn't stop you going there to play cabin games with Elizabeth Elliot, did it? Or has it gone downhill recently, because...
All right. The smile on the boys had turned to a grimace. You've made your point. Don't belabor it.
I stopped watching Miriam Bancroft and came back to my seat. My iced cocktail was still standing on the little table between us. I picked it up. I'm glad you take the point, I said, stirring the drink, because it's taken a lot of pain to sort through this mess. I've been abducted, tortured, and nearly killed in the process. A woman called Louise, not much older than your precious daughter Naomi, was killed because she'd got in the way. So if you don't like my conclusions, you can go fuck yourself. I raised my glass to him across the table.
Spare me the melodrama, Kovach, and sit down, for God's sake. I'm not rejecting what you say. I'm just questioning it.
I sat and leveled a finger at him. No, you're squirming. This thing's pointing up a part of your character you despise for its appetites. You'd rather not know what kind of software you were accessing that night over at Jacket Up, in case it's even more grubby than you already imagine. You're being forced to confront the part of yourself that wants to come in your wife's face, and you don't like it.
There will be no need to revisit that particular conversation, Bancroft said stiffly.
He steepled his fingers.
You are aware, I suppose, that the security camera footage you base your assumptions on could be faked very easily by anyone with access to news tape images of me.
Yes, I am. I'd watched Irene Elliott do exactly that only 48 hours previously. Easy wasn't the word. After the virus run, it had been like asking a concert total body dancer to encore with stretching exercises. I'd barely had time to smoke a cigarette while she did it. But why would anyone bother? A distractor to tinsel me off course, assuming, of course, that some wrong turn would have me sniffing around the ruins of a derelict Richmond Mall in the first place. Come on, Bancroft, get real. The fact I was out there in the first place proves the validity of that footage. And in any case, those images aren't the basis for anything. They just confirm what I'd already worked out, which is that you killed yourself to avoid viral contamination of your remote stack.
That is a quite remarkable leap of intuition to make after only a 6-day investigation.
Blame Ortega, I said lightly, though Bancroft's enduring suspicion in the face of unpleasant facts was beginning to worry me. I hadn't realized he would take so much wearing down. She's the one who put me onto the right track. She wouldn't wear the murder theory from the start. She kept telling me you were too tough and smart a meth motherfucker to let anyone kill you, quote-unquote. And that brought me back to the conversation we had here a week ago. You told me I'm not the kind of man to take my own life, and even if I was, I would not have bungled it in this fashion. If it had been my intention to die, you would not be talking to me now. Envoys have total recall. Those were your exact words. I paused and set down my glass, searching for the fine edge of deceit that always lies right up against the truth. All this time I've been working on the assumption you didn't pull the trigger because you weren't the type to commit suicide. I ignored all the evidence to the contrary because of that single assumption. The electron-tight security you've got here, the lack of any traces of intrusion, the handprint lock on the safe.
And Cadman? And Ortega?
Yeah, that didn't help. But we straightened out the Ortega angle, and Cadman... Well, I'm coming to Cadman in a moment. The point is, as long as I equated pulling that trigger with suicide, I was jammed. But then, what if those two acts were not synonymous? What if you'd torched your own stack not because you wanted to die, but for some other reason? Once I let myself think that, the rest was easy. What were the possible reasons that you'd do it? It's not an easy thing to put a gun to your own head, even if you do want to die. To do it when you want to live must take the will of a demon. No matter how much you might know intellectually that you'll be re-sleeved with the bulk of your mind intact, the person you are at that moment is going to die. You had to have been desperate to pull that trigger. It had to have been something, I smiled faintly, life-threatening. Given that assumption, it didn't take long to come up with a virus scenario. Then all I had to do was work out how and where he had been infected. Bancroft shifted uncomfortably at the word, and I felt a stab of elation run through me. Virus. Even Meths were afraid of the invisible corroder, because even they, with their remote storage and their clones on ice, were not immune. Viral strike. Stacked down. Bancroft was off balance. Now, it's virtually impossible to snug something as complex as a virus into a disconnected target, so you had to have been jacked in somewhere along the line. I thought of the Psychosec facility, but they're sewed up too tight. And it couldn't have been before you went to Osaka for the same reasons. Even dormant, the virus would have tripped every alarm at Psychosec when they set up the cast. It had to have been sometime in the last 48 hours, because your remote stack was uncontaminated. I knew from talking to your wife that the likelihood was you'd been out on the town when you got back from Osaka, and on your own admission, that could quite possibly include some kind of virtual whorehouse. After that, it was just a matter of doing the rounds. I tried a half-dozen places before I hit Jack It Up, and when I punched up their inquiries, the viral contam siren nearly blew my phone out. That's the thing about AIs. They write their own security, and it's second to none. Jack It Up is sealed off so tight it'll take the police months to tunnel in and see what's left of the core processors. I felt a vague pang of guilt as I thought of the AI, thrashing like a man in an acid vat as its systems dissolved around it, consciousness shriveling down a tunnel of closing perspectives into nothing. The feeling passed rapidly. We'd chosen Jack It Up for a variety of reasons. It was in a roofed-over area, which meant there would be no satellite coverage to dispute the lies we'd planted in the mall surveillance system. It operated in a criminal environment, so no one would have a problem believing an illicit virus had somehow got loose inside it. But most of all, it ran a series of software options so distasteful that it was unlikely the police would ever bother to investigate the wreckage of the murdered machine more than cursorily. Under its heading on Ortega's list, there were at least a dozen copycat sex crimes that the Organic Damage Division had traced to software packages available from Jack It Up. I could imagine the curl of Ortega's lip as she read the software listings, the studied indifference with which she would handle the case.
I missed Ortega.
What about Cadman?
It's hard to know, but I'm betting whoever infected Jack It Up in the first place probably hired Cadman to silence me and make sure the whole thing stayed covered up. After all, without me stirring things up, how long would it have been before anyone realized Jack had been iced? Can't see any of its potential clients calling the police when they got refused entry, can you?
Bancroft gave me a hard look, but I knew from his next words that the battle was almost over. The balance of belief was tipping toward me. Bancroft was going to buy the package.
You're saying the virus was introduced deliberately? That someone murdered this machine?
I shrugged. It seems likely. Jack It Up operated on the margins of local law. A lot of its software appears to have been impounded by the Transmission Felony Division at one time or another, which suggests that it had regular dealings with the criminal world in one form or another. It is possible that it made some enemies. On Harlan's world, the Yakuza had been known to perform viral execution on machines judged to have betrayed them. I don't know if that happens here, or who'd have the stack muscle to do it, but I do know that whoever hired Cadman used an AI to pull him out of police storage. You can verify that with Fell Street if you like.
Bancroft was silent. I watched him for a moment, seeing the belief sink in. Watching the process as he convinced himself, I could almost see what he was seeing. Himself, hunched over in an auto cab as the sordid guilt over what he had been doing at Jack It Up merged sickeningly with the horror of the contamination warning sirening in his head. Infected. Himself, Lorenz Bancroft, stumbling through the dark toward the lights of Suntouch House and the only surgery that could save him. Why had he left the cab so far from home? Why had he not wakened anybody for help? These were questions I no longer needed to answer for him. Bancroft believed. His guilt and self-disgust made him believe, and he would find his own answers to reinforce the horrific images in his head.
and by the time Transmission Felony cut a safe path through to Jacket Up's core processors, Rawling 4851 would have eaten out every scrap of coherent intellect the machine ever had. There would be nothing left to dispute.